Yeah, if the question is, I mean, I'm still back to the idea of whether or not you can generate internally a representation independent of external environment. So can you generate something fresh? And it's hard because of the feedback that the moment you generate that thought will have an emotional response, which then will feed back on itself. But where was it generated? And sleep and dreaming is an area where there's less external influence on it. And so the discussion about whether or not internal representations exclusively of the brain can generate and form images and perceptions independent of external stimuli or quasi-independent externally are better or perhaps clearer thought of in dreaming.
And in dreaming, the studies in the West show that approximately 2/3 of dreams are stressful. They have anxious content. Mm-hmm. Prior to the election in the U.S., I think the percentage is
increasing.
You have, hopefully, a one-week break from this.
It's much more pleasant here.
But if you take the example of, say, a practitioner doing retreat, is in a very, very neutral environment, basically in a small Hermitage, nothing changed, except perhaps the window is there, more or less clouds through the window, but that's about it. And what that person will be engaged from morning till evening will be to go to a series of exercise, could be visualization, could be training the mind to react in different way to emotional arisings, but the environment, I mean, of course, that will have an influence to the person's physiology, but there is no any reaction, new impulses, new perceptions, nothing. It's very blank. Yet, for hours and hours, there will be a constant transformation, enrichment, dealing with momentary emotions and thoughts that will, by adding up, will transform into mood and perhaps after months and years into traits. And so in that case, you reduce the influence of the environment to the minimum, though there is all this internal process taking place. There's no question of saying this purely the mind, and there's no repercussion in the brain. There is, obviously, but you reduce the maximum, the minimum possible influence of other sensory inputs, except becoming tired or something like that. So in that sense, here the enrichment, and it is, because it's very intense, you're facing challenges and you are trying to go through process that can be quite difficult to sustain, like attention, not being distracted, bringing back your attention, and dealing with emotion as they arise, and try to not to fall into patterns and mechanisms which automatic mechanisms of which we have no control. But still, this is a very rich experience, and with time, this leads to more permanent changes. So this is a very interesting situation to deal with inner enrichment over the long term.
Mm-hmm.
那这个呢，那个我写不出去了，怎么着？那个他呢，就按照他讲的，就那个，就是出去了，出去了。There's one type of a meditative retreat that's especially prevalent in the system called Kalachakra or Wheel of Time, and in the sequence of retreats, they'll engage in a period. In a discussion I've just had, maybe for 49 days, in which you're in a room, it actually has three walls, so you get ventilation, but it's pitch black. And it's also insulated from sound, so you're hearing virtually nothing. Your eyes are basically put out of work, even with your eyes wide open. And so you remain in that for maybe 49 days, and then you engage in your meditative practice.
So this is an actual room?
It's ongoing. I was just at a place in eastern Tibet where they're doing it. 50 monks are doing this. But His Holiness was saying, maybe a little bit in jest, while you're in a completely dark environment and completely quiet, your olfactory sense might be enhanced.
Wow. right. No.
Because
So you have very, very few external influences mm-hmm. for your sensory experience. That's the Tibetan approximation of a sensory deprivation tank. Well, and they'll stay in it for 49 days.
Mitchell was pointing out that even from the Western psychological point of view, even taking into account the biological facts of how new cells are born in the brain and they change and the old cells die, and over a period of time there's a complete turnover. But since the complete turnover is not happening at one time, there's the structural continuity. And on the basis of the structural continuity, the sense of selfhood and the continuity of the individual can be maintained. So this is how the Buddhists would, you know, look at that problem. And then His Holiness raises the point that as to the notion of, you know, a sense of permanence, is it something that is kind of intellectually acquired, or is it something that is kind of, you know, natural?
Is it innate or acquired through learning? Yeah.
So within the monastic debate texts that authors, there was one particular author who rejected the idea that there can be an innate notion of a sense of permanence. So I was saying that this is his own peculiarity, but, you know, what's the problem with maintaining that there could be an innate sense of permanence? But this author turned out to be the author of the textbook of a monastery I belong to. So His Holiness was saying, now you're rebelling. Becoming a traitor. Of course, the Buddha has given us the liberty to analyze and examine.
Everything is open to investigation.
So he utilized that.
That's right. Well,
just a small thing about this sensory isolation and generating, you know, enrichment, is that it does happen. I mean, just to go a little bit on about these dark retreats, that people start, you know, seeing things, and then they try very, I mean, one of the issue is to try to, this seems real, at the same time to relate with what we usually perceive as real. And so that's a very crucial experience from experience point of view to assess the nature of reality that we perceive.
And you start to hallucinate.
Because those are clearly projections of the mind. Yeah. And they are not complete hallucination, because also they are sometimes the result of your practice, depending upon the subject of your practice, not any kind of, you're not necessarily going to see your dog or something, but it's related to the practice itself. So it is arising from the practice, yet it is product of the mind, yet it is as a vivid appearances. So those are very, you know, the limit between mind and your reality then becomes sort of fading away.
Well, one of the issues that I wanted to raise concerns directly is pertinent to that. It concerns the role of mental training. And in preparation for this meeting, Your Holiness, I surveyed the Western scientific literature, all of the literature in the biobehavioral sciences. And there are preciously few experimental studies.
Just very few.
Very few. Less than 10 rigorous scientific studies on the role of pure mental training on either behavior or the brain. The role of mental training in general has been ignored in the Western biobehavioral sciences. There are a few studies in sports where athletes imagine going through a particular activity to evaluate its impact on their performance. But and there are some studies that use mental imagery in therapy that I will talk a little bit about later in the week. But and then there are a few studies on visual mental imagery. But other than the visual mental imagery work, there really is... There's virtually nothing. And it seems that in the West, the belief, the strategies that scientists and clinicians have developed to promote change have been strategies that have been based more on external factors than on mental training. So there's a very big difference in emphasis.
I mean, this is to some extent understandable. Probably it has some historical reasons too, because maybe, you know, at some subconscious level people regard the mental training aspect to be belonging to either spirituality or religion or something.
And isn't that really a historical issue, that science has so defined itself as being not religion, that is very, very shy about letting anything that looks or smacks of religion creeping into it as if it were to be a contamination? I sense that from psychology. That's why there's so little research on virtues, because that's supposed to be what the religious people do, or psychologists would rather study pathologies.
Well, I think the reason why we emphasize on mental training is the observation that the outer conditions, you know, are very important contributory factor to our well-being or suffering, but in the end, the mind is can override that. You can be retain inner strength and well-being in a very difficult situation, and you can be totally wrecked in very apparently where everything seems perfect. And so, knowing that, then what are the inner conditions for well-being and for suffering, and how? And then if those are can override the outer conditions, then try to distinguish those that will favor, nourish well-being, and those will be detrimental to it. And then comes a whole taxonomy of emotion and mental events. And then the question then, can you do something about it? If not, if getting rid of hatred is destroying yourself, then you won't. If it's totally intrinsic, you will destroy yourself. But if there is a way of changing that, then what are the methods? So that's mental training is about, observing the effects, trying to find all kinds of antidotes. And there's no way we could go in details in that, but there is a whole array of antidotes, either directly antagonizing a mental factor like hatred by the opposite, saying that you cannot blow and shake hands in the same gesture. Those are incompatible. So hatred and benevolence are incompatible at the same moment. Or you can deal with the arising of hatred, so to dissolve it before it triggers chain reactions. So all that is what we call mental training. And it implies repetition, because you have to attend to every arising of that destructive emotion. But within the repetition, there's an accumulation with time. So therefore, it's gradually is going to change the basic baseline. So in that sense, that's what we basically will call mental training. It's constantly attending to mental events with a sense of direction, with a sense of transformation that will take time, and being attentive, diligent, and have a sense of continuity. So in a, to deal with the inner conditions of well-being and suffering. So, and that can have all kinds of technology and methods. Can have visualization, can have different exercise, way of dealing with thoughts. And that's, again, a very rich environment. The novelty is to what comes out of that. And yet, it has to deal with every moment. And the accumulation of that will bring change.
Aren't you describing something very akin to a cognitive basis of psychotherapy? Mm-hmm. And for
it's
which
the closest, really, I think, I guess.
Which is, and I mean, the irony is that we have a very well accepted therapeutic approach, which is known to be as successful in dealing with emotionally very painful disorders.
I know.
We have studies on it, and yet we haven't quite taken that and integrated into neuroscience.
But the thing is, you know, there's a 2,000-year actual experience. It's not just like a theory that we keep on repeating ourselves. People have been doing that, and you know, and some of people would do, you know, hours and hours a day for years and years. So there's an accumulation of in the technology and the methods used. There's incredible richness. But I think the principle of you know, cognitive therapies is something very similar.
We're actually working on a program that was actually inspired during our Mind and Life conference in the year 2000, with His Holiness, of course, when His Holiness gave the challenge, well, can we turn this into something practical? The theme was destructive emotions. Paul Ekman then conceived of the program that we're now well into development of cultivating emotional balance, where we're selecting various types of Buddhist meditative practices, mind training, and then integrating these with various methods from cognitive behavioral therapy, from Paul Ekman's own work in emotional regulation and identification. And they dovetail very, very smoothly, actually, because they seem to be really working at the same level. Whereas cognitive behavioral therapy is primarily devised, it seems, to get people up to normal, and then you send them out the door. I mean, it's not really aimed primarily at bringing about exceptional states of compassion, of virtue, and so forth and so on, but rather to deal with pathologies, with problems. Whereas, I mean, I'm happy to hear your response, but Buddhism, of course, is designed to heal the afflictions of the mind, but the same type of therapy or meditative practices, the mind training, is also designed to bring about exceptional states of balanced focused attention, of compassion, empathy, patience, and so forth. But please, I think you'll want to respond.
I wouldn't draw I completely agree with what you're saying, but I wouldn't draw so tight a distinction between pathology, normal, and
exceptional.
Beyond exceptional. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the word. Mm-hmm. Generally, I think when people who practice the therapy will deal with what the individual feels as a complaint themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that may not simply represent a pathology, but it may represent the aspiration to be better or exceptional within a particular domain.